here to tell us? Mathilde tears a sliver of meat off her plate. The lamb is succulent. There is no need for cutting. Even so, she takes forever to chew. Waiting, Jules vows that she will not believe a word out of the seer's mouth. And at the same time, she hopes to hear some other vision, some news about Arsinoe and Billy and how they fare on the mainland. Is Arsinoe happy there? Is she safe? Did they give Joseph a fine funeral? It seems an age since she left them that day, bobbing before the mainland. That day that the mist of Fenburn swallowed her up again and brought her and Camden home. She would even settle for news about Mirabella. The truth of you is yet to come, Mathilde says finally. I know only that you were once a queen, and may be again. Those words came into my head like a chant the moment that I looked at you. The Mainland. At the sound of the bell, the horses take off from the starting line, hooves and tails flying. Arsinoe grips the rail in front of her seat and pulls herself nearly up and over it to watch as they thunder past, every horse shining and beautiful, and each with a tiny man clinging onto its back for dear life. There they go, she shouts. They're rounding that turn that you said. The clubhouse turn. Billy grasps her by the back of her dress, laughing. Now get down from there, before you fall into the next row. With a sigh, she puts her feet back on solid ground. But she is not the only one out of her seat. Plenty of others have stood to clap or hold clever little magnifying glasses up to their eyes. Even Mirabella has risen on the other side of Billy, crowding so close in her excitement that he can hardly breathe between the two sisters. Fun as this is, Arsinoe says, it would be even more fun to be down there beside the track. She takes a deep breath, smells roasted nuts, and her stomach growls. The view might not be as good, says Mirabella, and Billy nods. His father paid good money every year for these fine seats, or so Billy had told them on the way to the track. How about from the back of a horse, then? They don't allow girls to ride, Billy says, and Arsinoe frowns. They would change their minds soon enough if only they could see Jules. Small, wiry Jules who could weave her horse in and out of a herd as though the two were of one body. On the racetrack, the horses cross the finish line to a chorus of mixed cheers and groans. The last race of the day, and none of the horses they had bet upon had won. But the three of them stand up, smiling. Arsinoe takes Billy's hand in her left and pulls Mirabella along with her right as they make their way down from the seats. Her ill-fitting gray dress riding up over the legs of the trousers she insists on always wearing underneath. By contrast, Mirabella looks lovely in white, full sleeves and lace to her throat. Before they left the island, neither had worn any color besides black, and Mirabella a few colored jewels. But Mirabella, with her beauty, manages to look at home in anything. Arsinoe takes a deep breath. It is pleasant to be out, even if the warm summer air smells like city instead of the sea. Sometimes Billy's family's brick row house, fine though it may be, can feel so stifling. As they turn down the avenue in the midst of the crowds, she bumps a shoulder into a passerby. Before she can apologize, he recoils at the sight of her scars, still bright pink and running down the right side of her face. Billy makes a fist, and Mirabella opens her mouth, but Arsinoe pulls them back. Never mind it. Let's just go. They do, but closer to her and just ahead, their shoulders protecting her shoulders. Their scowls a barrier against anyone who might slight her. Good goddess, she says and laughs. You lot are as bad as jewels. They walk on, navigating the crowds and watching the cabs and carriages pass. It is busier even than Indrid down High Street, and never seems to slow. A cab dashes by, pulled by a poor bony horse, his back a wreck of whiplashes. "Oi! Go easy on him, will ya?" Arsinoe shouts, but the cabbie only sneers. "If only I had the fullness of my lightning," Mirabella adds, "or my fire, I would start a cozy flame in the pocket of his pants." But she does not. Away from the island, their gifts weaken and fade. Even if Arsinoe were a true naturalist instead of a poisoner, she may not have had enough left to comfort the horse anyway. Billy shakes his head. "Don't try to tell me that no one mistreated their horses on Fenburn." But his eyes lose focus as he tries to remember an example. Even in the capital, respect for the naturalist gift kept the worst of abuses in check. Arsinoe curses when someone runs into her from behind. She does not know if she will ever get used to the crowds. And somehow, she is always the one jostled. Something in Mirabella is still regal, and no one comes within a foot. "Oh, no," says Billy. They have reached the end of their street, the row of grand red brick houses with wrought iron gates and front steps of bright white stone. But clustered around their doorway is a gaggle of young ladies in dresses of pink and green and pale yellow. It can only be Christine Holland, the governor's daughter, and her ever-present troop of society friends. Arsinoe looks up to the window of the third-floor room she shares with Mirabella. With 4 stories worth of rooms in the townhouse, they had not really needed to share. But when she and Mirabella had arrived on the mainland, legs shaking and clothes still soaked from the storm, they had clung to each other's elbows and refused to let go. So Billy's mother, Mrs. Chatworth, had directed them, lips trembling, to one of the larger guest rooms. "I don't know if I have the stomach for this today," Arsinoe mutters. Christine Holland had apparently set her cap at Billy during the time he was away on the island, and no amount of Arsinoe's presence seemed able to deter her. If Arsinoe had to endure one more tea, watching Christine paw and fawn over Billy, she was likely to behave in a way that Mrs. Chatworth would deem unladylike, or even more unladylike than usual. "There's no way we can scale the bricks and sneak in through our window?" "Not without being seen," Mirabella says with a smirk. She touches Arsinoe's shoulder. "You go. Take off a while until they have gone."
"What?"
"Yes, what?" Billy asks. "I've no desire to be left alone in there with my mother and Christine. If you go, Arsinoe, you might return to find me gagged and engaged."
"Go," Mirabella says again. Maybe you should visit Joseph."
"Do you mean it?" Arsinoe asks.
"Of course I do. Why ruin a perfectly lovely day?"
"What about Miss Holland and the governor's girls?"
Mirabella steps closer to Billy and slips her hand into the crook of his arm. Just that simple movement and change of posture, a subtle shift in her hips, a slight incline of her head, and anyone watching would think that she and Billy were madly in love. Well, were it not for the shocked look on Billy's face. "You leave Christine Holland to me." Arsinoe glances at the girls up the street. All are girls Mrs. Chatworth will gladly welcome into her home and would gladly marry her son to. Girls who are nothing like the strange foreign ones she took in. They dress in proper skirts and do not have deep scars on their faces. Christine Holland, in particular, is one of the prettiest people Arsinoe has ever seen. Golden hair and peach cheeks, a smile that dazzles. That she is also quite rich seems just plain unfair. Arsinoe smiles at Mirabella, gratefully. Poor Christine doesn't stand a chance. Arsinoe takes off through the city, skirting the row houses by way of alleys and side streets. She is relieved to not face another strained meeting with Christine, who looks at her as if she is some kind of bug when she bothers to acknowledge her at all. But the farther away she gets, the more her relief is replaced by resentment. In the gray sack of a dress,
With no friends or family, save Billy and Mirabella, no fortune or prospects of her own, she is no match for Christine Holland. She would be, if things were different. If she were still herself in her black trousers and vest, a fierce black and red slashed mask over the scars on her face. If she were still a queen. Her legs hasten as she makes her way through the streets, heading for Joseph, ignoring the stares from people she passes by. Stares she attracts merely by running, by being a girl out on her own without the benefit of an escort or a parasol. She should not have gone off alone. She should have stayed and choked down her tea. It is only when she is alone that the doubt creeps in, that feeling that she does not belong here and never will. When they first arrived, both she and Mirabella had tried to charm Mrs. Chatworth. Arsinoe especially had been prepared to like her or even love her. She was Billy's mother, after all. She had raised a boy who would stand by his friends. So when they met, she expected to find someone like Kate Malone, with a stern face and a stout heart, and strong arms for holding her children. Or even someone like Ellis, never serious, but always ready with advice. Instead, Billy's mother was worse even than his father in some ways. She lacked substance, and her facial expressions vacillated between irritated and horrified. By the time she reaches the cemetery gates, Arsinoe's legs burn from exertion, but her frustration has not been spent. She slows to a walk, respectful of those at rest, yet cannot help kicking feebly at pebbles on the path. "Parasols," she mutters. "Frilly dresses and silly games. That is all there is for a girl to do here. Drink tea and twirl a parasol until she gets married." And to be married on the mainland means to obey. If there is one word in the world sure to get Arsinoe's hackles up, it is that one. Thank the goddess Billy does not want that. Her Billy, who only wants her to be what she is and for her and Mirabella to be happy. Which she is, most days. It is only when she is alone that she remembers that she is not one of them. Not even Mirabella will be accepted as one of them, and Mirabella follows all their rules. Arsinoe pauses and takes a breath. The cemetery where Joseph is buried is set out on the edges of the city and surrounded by stone walls. It is quiet and sunlit, marked by gentle hills and groves of trees, and overlooks the deep blue water of the bay. It is a place Jules would have liked. Arsinoe likes it too, for it is always nearly empty. She follows the path through the northern entrance and past the loose bricks near the Richmond family markers, then cuts through the grass toward the grove of elm trees. Their shade just reaches Joseph, where he rests near the top of the hill. Before she gets there, she slips into the shadow of the largest tree and strips off her gray sack of a dress. Then she shakes out her rough-cut hair and smooths her shirt, an old one that Billy grew out of, before she clears her throat and says, "Hello, Joseph."
"Hello, Arsinoe,"
says the Joseph in her mind, and for a moment her eyes blur. His grave marker is simple, unadorned. No ornate carvings of ivy, no marble sculptures. It is not a fancy mausoleum with stained glass windows and its own private gate. It is a patch of grass and a dark, rounded stone. She blinks hard and runs her fingers along the inscription. "Here lies Joseph Sandrin, beloved of Jules, brother to Billy, a friend to queens and cougars." It is what she told them to write. It does not matter that no one on the mainland will understand what it means, that in years to come, visitors to the cemetery might puzzle over it and think it a joke. The engraving took some time, and when they buried him, the grave had to go unmarked except for a white piece of wood. When the stone was ready, they returned and mourned all over again. On the island, he would have been burned on a pyre, and his ashes spread in Sealhead Cove. They would have stood together on the deck of the Whistler while the people of Wolf Spring threw petals and grain from the docks. Instead, he is here under the dirt and far from home. But Arsinoe is glad of that now. At least, buried, there is a place that she can come and talk to him.
We went to the races today.
We didn't win. She lowers herself to the ground and balls up her gray dress for something to lie upon.
And then I had to run away when Christine Holland was at our door. Not that I wouldn't have come to see you anyway.
Christine Holland, the governor's daughter.
Do you know her?
Arsinoe turns her head.
I'm sure you knew her. She probably fancied you to begin with, didn't she? Probably fainted dead away at the sight of you. It doesn't take much.
But you weren't from here, and you weren't staying. And Billy's rich, and...
She clears her throat.
Not bad to look at.
In her mind, she hears Joseph's laughter, and then a low rumble of thunder as clouds begin to roll from over the sea.
It's going to rain.
I wonder if that means Mirabella's upset about something. She swears that her gift has all but left her. But I've seen her close her eyes and then felt the coolness of a breeze. And then there's the fact that her melancholy days always seem to wind up overcast. She snorts. A gift like hers is too strong to be stifled, even by the mainland.
She looks up at the sky. She has nothing but time now. Time to wait for Billy to make a life for them. And the thought of his needing to do that sends her stomach into knots. Who is she here? Not Queen Arsinoe, raised as a naturalist and discovered to be a poisoner. Now, she is nothing. A rogue queen with no crown. She turns toward Joseph's marker.
Christine is much prettier than me.
Lots of girls are much prettier than you, Joseph replies in her mind. But none of them are you.
Arsinoe smiles. So he would say, if he were here. If he could put an arm around her shoulders and squeeze. If he were not in a box, in the ground.
I miss you, Joseph, she says, her head resting on the ball of her dress. I miss you so much.
And then she falls asleep.
Who knows how long later, Arsinoe wakes with a start. Her arms fly out to her sides, certain for a moment that she will find not ground at all, but the water of a bay.
What a strange dream.
She was a girl, dressed as a boy on a boat. It had been vivid as being there. But as she lies still and tries to remember, it comes apart, driven back by the fading orange light and a soreness in her back from sleeping on the grass. She pushes up onto her elbow with a groan and looks toward Joseph's grave marker. There is a woman in a long black dress standing behind it. She scrambles up onto her knee and rubs her eyes, thinking she is still dreaming. But the vision does not waver. The woman in black is darker than a shadow. Arsinoe cannot see her face or the details of her clothing. Only her shape and her long black hair.
Who are you?
The figure raises her skeletal arm and stretches one long finger to point. Arsinoe turns and looks over the hilltop toward the harbor. Nothing there but ships in the evening. At least, nothing in that direction that any mainlander would know about.
No,
Arsinoe says. And the woman's sharp finger extends farther.
No!
She squeezes her eyes shut. When she opens them, the woman is gone. If indeed, she was ever really there. The Volroy.
It was never going to be an amicable meeting, Peter says, seated upon Katarine's sofa. No one likes to have power wrested from them, and Lucas' choices were... unexpected.
Unexpected? Genevieve scoffs as she storms back and forth with her arms crossed. They were intentionally antagonizing. Katerine sighs. Peter has poured her a cup of tea and even added a splash of oleander milk, but she does not want it. She has been listening to him argue with Genevieve since they returned to her rooms after the meeting of the Black Council.
"Intentional or not," says Peter, "you squawked like an upset bird. Is that how Natalia would have reacted? You have none of your sister's composure, Genevieve, absolutely none of it."
Genevieve spins. "How dare you speak so to me? I am her sister, not some errant nephew. And I am the head of the family now, not your father."
"I never said it would be my father."
"Oh, enough of this."
Katerine rises with a huff and goes to the window to throw open the shutters and let in the warm summer air. She breathes it in and looks down. All that sea and sky, the treetops and bright green spaces, all the good people, all hers.
"Can you not see the beauty of these days? The gold in the sunlight? The crown etched into my head?"
She turns to them, her smile wide.
"We won! You are too entrenched in the chaos of the ascension still to see it, but we won. And my reign will not be a time of bitterness and contention."
She steps toward them with her hands out. Peter scrunches his brow. Genevieve goes pale, as if unsure Katerine is not about to fling a knife at her head. "It will be a reign of ease and prosperity." She takes Genevieve's hand, lightly, so she will not flinch. "And new beginnings."
"Are you so ready to forget the past?" Genevieve asks.
"I am ready to set old grudges aside. And so should you. I will need the two of you in harmony now, to make sure Bree Westwood does not get into any trouble."
Peter stands and straightens his cuffs. He considers shaking Genevieve's hand, but at the last moment changes his mind, and they settle on a curt nod.
"The Queen is to be commended for her optimism," he says. "I hope she is right."
"I hope so too," says Genevieve.
"You will see."
Katerine rises on tiptoe to kiss Peter fully on the mouth, her mood lifting, along with her words, as though that, too, can be changed by sheer will.
"To set the tone, we will hold a welcome banquet in the square, a warm gesture for the High Priestess and the Westwoods, to signal to the people that the crown is settled."
Peter cocks an eyebrow.
"If Luca and the others will agree to it."
"Of course they will agree to it," Katerine says, and laughs. "I am the queen."
Katerine invites High Priestess Luca on a tour of the capital to reacquaint her with it after being so long away. It could be taken as a jibe, she supposes, the out-of-touch High Priestess with her heart still in Rolanth. But she does not mean it like that. When she arrives at Indra Down Temple on her fine black stallion, she and her queen's guard find Luca already mounted and waiting beside three priestesses. Katerine's eyes linger on slivers of exposed blade at each priestess's waist.
Is it the practice now that all priestesses be armed?
Not all, Luca replies, but certainly those who are escorting the High Priestess and the Queen crowned. Ro insisted.
Did she?
Katerine swallows. War-gifted Ro. Somehow Katerine knows that, had the plan to cut off her arms and head after the quickening come to pass, it would have been Ro doing most of the carving. And now she serves on the Black Council. Katerine looks away from the knives and back at Luca.
You look very well on horseback, High Priestess.
Luca nods, and her horse dances in place as though it understands.
They tried to put me on a white mule,
she snorts,
but I am not that old yet.
Instead of a mule, her mount is a large white stallion. Now Katerine will have to keep their horses at a distance so their stallions will not fight, which is perhaps precisely what Luca intended.
How are you finding Indrid down? Catherine asks as they ride, making their way through High Street, past her favorite cheese shop and Genevieve's favorite dressmaker.
Hotter than I remember, says Luca. And once winter comes, I am sure I will find it colder than I remember.
But not more drafty than Roland, surely, with its open-air temple and cliffside breezes? How many times had Natalia hoped through gritted teeth for the damp and drafts to finally kill off old Luca?
Not as drafty?
Luca cocks her head.
Nor as light, nor as lovely. The capital craves brightness and beauty. It is a good thing I appointed Bree to the council, for she is both of those things.
They skirt the Dowling Marketplace, which they are unable to enter with their horses, and Catherine points out stalls of particular quality as Lucas smiles and waves to the people. They are thrilled that the High Priestess is back in the capital where she belongs. Those closest reach out to touch the edges of her robes and ask for blessings. Catherine, they ask for nothing. To her, they only bow.
They fear you, Luca mutters.
Of course they do. But they will love me, too. Natalia always said the island loves a bloody ascension. I was the only one who tried to give them that. They stop at the bluff, where the street rises before gradually sloping to the harbor, and the party members lean on their pommels, admiring the view of the sea in the afternoon light. Far to the north, around the curve of the harbor, the early wooden skeletons of ships rise on the dry land. They are the ships that Peter and the council ordered built for the Martells as payment for Nicholas's death, and Catherine does not mention them.
I would like to hold a welcome banquet, in your honor.
Catherine turns in the saddle as Luca raises her eyebrows.
To welcome you, and Bree Westwood, and Roe Mertra to the city, so the people might see their new black council together as one. We will hold it in the square.
How very kind.
Luca looks away again toward the port.
Bree will love that. She is always danced off her feet at parties.
High Priestess, one of their escorts say.
Look, the mist.
They follow the priestess's pointing arm out over the water. It is the mist, rising above the surface. It is not much, really, and could be easily overlooked by a less careful eye. It is just substantial enough that Catherine can see it swirling, and something in her blood tightens while she watches it.
It is not often visible, she hears herself say.
Not from here, anyway.
Is it often visible in Roland?
No, not often.
Lucas sighs.
It is only the goddess.
Yes, says Catherine.
And the curdle in her veins is only the dead queens, who have no love anymore for her.
Only the goddess, Lucas says again. Keeping something out, or something in.
Bastion City. A night and a day after seeing the oracle at the inn, Jules cannot stop thinking about the prophecy. If it can even be called that. It was a feeling, the oracle said. Words that came into her mind.
I know only that you were once a queen, and may be again.
What a vague bunch of half-truths. If that is how it always is with the sight gift, then Jules does not envy them.
I wouldn't even trade my legion curse for it, she mutters to Camden, who pricks her ears.
The mountain cat stands up on her hind paws, her forepaws on the ledge of the room's solitary above-ground window, so streaked and spattered with mud that she can barely tell what time of day it is. Jules pats her shoulder.
Maybe we should have gone with Arsinoe to the mainland after all.
How can you say that, after hearing what Mathilde said? Jules turns. Amelia is standing in the doorway.
Jules did not hear her approach down the stairs, nor did she hear the door open. More impressively, neither had Camden. I didn't hear Mathilde say anything but nonsense, but I noticed that you didn't seem surprised. That is because she said what I expected. Amelia gestures toward the low ceiling, the one window. This is not the finest room for a queen, but for one who must be concealed, it is the best choice. Jules scoffs. I am no queen. She tugs at the ends of her short brown hair. Look at this, all brown. And these? She points to her eyes. Two different colors, and not one of them black. You've met my mother, Madrigal. Not a drop of sacred blood there, I can assure you. I didn't say you were of the queen's line. Amelia ducks her head, showing the rolled buns at the nape of her neck. Even wandering her own house, she appears formal, in brown boots and a knee-length skirt with deep pleats. Clothes on the vatresses have the look of a uniform, no matter the cut or material. Then, what are you saying? I am saying that the time of those queens is over. Jules blinks. The line of queens has been in place on Fenburn for all recorded history. Is that so? She murmurs. And what about Queen Catherine, then? The one who sits on the throne, with a crown etched into her forehead? Another poisoner puppet. Poisoner or not, she is the queen crowned. It is the island's way. Amelia crosses her arms. What if I told you there is a movement growing of people who feel betrayed by the bloodline, who will not stand for another poisoner to rule above another poisoner's council? I would say you were lying. Jules pats Camden on the rump, and the cougar hops onto the bed. She lies down facing Amelia with her paws crossed, as would a child awaiting a good story. Queens have always killed queens, and the island accepts the outcome. But this queen did not kill. She tried. I was there. She failed. She was not the chosen queen, and the island knows it. Even some of the northern priestesses... Amelia strolls to the window and peers through the mud. The botched ascension was a sign. The debacle of the quickening was a sign. You yourself are a sign. Too many signs to ignore. And now, even the pious will stand with us. Us? Who is us? Do you believe in these signs? Or do you believe in the will of the goddess? I believe that it is time for change, and that the goddess's will is for us to make that change. The Mainland. Mirabella sips her tea as her eyes drift to the clock. It is full dark, and Arsinoe is still not home from visiting Joseph at the cemetery. Mrs. Chatworth's foot has begun to tap, and Billy's sister, Jane, has arched her eyebrow and sighed twice. Even Billy has gotten up to peer through the curtains. I should have gone with her, he says regretfully.
It's not as though you could abandon Miss Holland, says Jane, and Mirabella sips her tea again.
Arsinoe thinks that Mirabella has fallen in with the mainlanders so easily that she has changed her feathers and joined the flock. In truth, sometimes it is so hard not to scream that she almost cracks her teeth holding her mouth shut.
Arsinoe has been left to run wild. I know it has not been easy for you girls coming to a new place, Mrs. Chatworth says, finally speaking, though her eyes remain fixed on the tablecloth.
She never looks at Mirabella when referring to the island or their past. Mirabella does not even know how much about the island Mrs. Chatworth knows. Billy says she knows everything, but if that is true, she seems to have done a fine job of forgetting about it.
Indeed, it must have been very hard, she goes on. But we cannot be expected to corral her at every turn.
Corral? Mirabella bristles.
Perhaps that is an unfair term, but the fact remains that my son will not be able to look after her forever. Soon enough, he'll be at university. And then he must make a profitable marriage and start a family of his own.
Billy winces, especially at the word marriage.
University, Mirabella says to him, and raises her eyebrows. You have not told Arsinoe of this.
It's not far. A few hours ride by coach. I'll be home every Saturday and in between terms.
Mirabella rises from the table, and the other women stare at her above the rims of their teacups.
Excuse us a moment. I would speak to Billy alone.
No, please, Mrs. Chatwer says, clearly irritated. Why should my guest be made to leave the room when I could? Come, Jane, let us retire. I've had quite enough of the tedium of waiting.
Mirabella steps aside as she and Jane quit the room and walk with straight backs up the stairs.
I know what you're going to say, Billy says, as soon as he hears both of their bedroom doors shut.
Do you?
It's just that I haven't known how to tell her, or you.
He looks at her guiltily and ruffles his sandy hair.
I feel a complete ass, leaving you like this. But I have to go. If we're going to make a life here, I need an education. We're rich, but not so rich that I can simply be a man of leisure.
He goes to the window to look again for Arsinoe.
If only my father would come home.
Are you surprised he has not returned already?
He shrugs. After the way I defied him on Fenburn, I wouldn't be surprised if he sailed all the way around the world before coming back, with stops at every friendly port. Or he could return tomorrow, and when he sees you and Arsinoe, that's not a conversation I'm looking forward to having.
It seems there are many conversations you are not looking forward to having.
Mira, are you cross with me? I haven't seen that look on your face since the day I met you in Roland and threatened to skewer you through the neck.
Do not be silly. She softens at the memory. I was cross with you nearly every time you cooked for me.
Kept you from being poisoned, didn't I?
He grins, but it fades quickly.
Well, except for that last time.
That was no one's fault. But do not change the subject.
What subject? I thought we were just waiting for your sister.
Mirabella goes to the window and snatches the curtains out of his fingers.
About my sister, she says.
How many times have I heard your mother hint about how much happier Arsinoe would be at your country estate, hidden away from you, and away from anyone who might view her as an embarrassment? How many times have they mentioned Christine Holland as your potential bride?
Lots, I suppose.
Then when are you going to tell them about you and Arsinoe? That she will not be sent away? That you will not be cowed into marrying someone else?
Billy lowers his head.
He is a handsome young man. Many times Mirabella has thought so. His looks are less dramatic than Joseph's were. He is less like a thunderstorm. He is real and of the earth. He is what her sister needs. Or at least he was. But here on the mainland, he is no longer the daring suitor who risked everything for them. On the island, he was courageous, with an outsider's bravado. Here, when girls call him a rogue, they only mean he is trying to get under several skirts at once.
If you regret bringing us here, she says carefully, if you do not intend to be with Arsinoe, then I will take her someplace else. I am not without skill or cleverness. I can make a life for us.
Billy stares at her, almost like he does not believe her. But then he takes her hand.
That's the last thing I want. I will tell them. You have my word. I won't leave her without assurances.
Before Mirabella can say anything further, he sees movement through the curtains and exclaims,
"She's here!"
He opens the door and reveals Arsinoe, shivering and soaking wet on the front step, with what looks to be a dirty fur rolled up beneath her arm. Then Billy embraces her,
and the fur barks. I found him in an alley after some boys chased him down there with sticks. Arsinoe holds the dog, squirming, to her chest.
Poor thing, says Billy. But he's filthy, Arsinoe. My mother will have a fit if you bring him in here.
No, see, she says and runs her hand over the little dog's back. Under all the scum, he's got a pretty brown and white coat. I thought we'd clean him up and put a ribbon on him. Give him to your mother and Jane as a peace offering.
She steps farther into the foyer as Billy rubs his forehead and chuckles. Distracted as he is by the dog, he does not notice the haunted look in Arsinoe's eyes. Nor does he note how hard she is shivering, far too hard for someone who has just come in from a warm summer rain.
Let us take him into the washroom then, Mirabella says. Quietly.
Once they are in the washroom, Mirabella sends Billy to heat water for a bath and to fetch extra lamps. When he is gone, she pulls a blanket down from a shelf and wraps her sister in it.
Now, she says, what is really the matter?
Nothing. I saw this dog get chased, and I wanted to save it. It's how I was raised.
Yes, yes. Mirabella smiles softly. Poisoner by birth, naturalist at heart. But there is more to this. Why did you stay gone for so long?
I fell asleep, Arsinoe answers, eyebrows down so Mirabella knows she is not telling her everything.
But it will have to wait. Billy is returning with the hot water and lamps.
So they set the dog in the wash basin, and Mirabella reaches for soap.
It is a good thing Mrs. Chatworth and Jane are already in bed, Mirabella says. They would be beside themselves if they knew you had taken off your dress in public.
It wasn't in public. It was in the graveyard behind a tree. And besides, I had all these clothes on underneath.
They finish bathing the dog, who really is quite a lovely fellow underneath all the muck, and towel him dry before Arsinoe carries him up to their bedroom. Billy does not leave her side until they are in the doorway and then leans in to kiss her cheek.
Don't worry me so much, he whispers.
Then don't worry so easily, Arsinoe whispers back.
Good night, Billy, Mirabella says, and closes the door. She goes to Arsinoe's dresser for dry clothes while Arsinoe gets the dog settled into bed.
Here, get out of that shirt and into something dry.
I'm all right. I am the oldest.
Mirabella holds the nightshirt out.
Do as I say.
Or what?
We're not on the island anymore. You're all out of lightning bolts.
But Arsinoe unbuttons the shirt and takes it off, then pulls the quilt off her bed to wrap herself in.
This place is going to make us soft. Everything's so precious and fancy. Look at this wall covering.
She taps her finger against the pattern of raised green velvet.
It seems like a tapestry, but if you pick at it, it's paper. It peels.
Arsinoe, stop that. Mrs. Chatworth will cut your hands off. Besides, according to you, I was always soft, raised in Roland on a fat bed of priestesses. She looks at her sister's still shivering shoulders.
Now tell me what really happened today.
Nothing. I fell asleep and I rescued a dog. How was tea with Christine and the governor's girls?
Did you manage to put her off, Billy? Arsinoe blinks innocently and gathers the dog into her arms.
Something had happened.
Mirabella would know it by the electricity in the air, even if it were not written all over Arsinoe's frightened face. But she also knows by the set of her sister's jaw that she will get no more answers tonight.
Sentra.
When Arsinoe falls asleep, she dreams the same dream she had when she was sleeping beside Joseph's grave, which is odd, as she cannot remember ever having had the same dream twice. In it, she is again on a ship, not a ship like she is accustomed to, but an old ship, with one mast,
the kind that merchants used to use and went out of fashion at least a century ago. And again, she is not herself, but someone else, a girl dressed as a boy. Also, she is up very high in the rigging, staring out at fast-moving waves that make her stomach lurch.
David! Get down from that rigging!
Yes, yes, let's get down from this rigging, Arsinoe thinks, her own legs weak, though the legs of her dream body navigate the ropes and nets without any trouble.
Richard, you never let me have any fun.
The girl, whose body Arsinoe shares, whose name is actually Daphne, not David, lands on the deck and tugs her tunic down over her leggings. Old-fashioned clothes, nothing like anything Arsinoe has ever worn, and not terribly comfortable either.
You shouldn't be here to begin with, Richard says. You know women are bad luck on a ship.
Keep your voice down, Daphne says, with a glance toward the other sailors. And it's not as if you would have the nerve to steal the ship without me.
Borrowed, only borrowed.
The wind flags in the sail as the ship turns back toward the port. Daphne, and by extension, Arsinoe in Daphne's body, looks to the stern where a boy has given up the wheel. He is Henry Redville, Lord Henry Redville, from the country of Sentra, and he makes his way to her and Richard and throws his arm around them.
How are my two favorite wards? Henry asks. She is not a ward, says Richard. She's a foundling. A foundling scooped from the sea, the lone survivor of one wreck, and sure to be the cursed cause of another with her penchant for sailing in disguise.
You know, Richard, says Daphne, when you were small, your nurses said you were sickly and want to die.
Arsinoe feels her own ribs squeezed as Henry hugs them together, as though to reconcile them by force. And it works. Richard and Daphne laugh.
I suppose she is not a curse, says Richard. How could she be, when she is already a sea monster stuffed into a baby's skin?
And never forget it. Now stop calling me she. I am still David in tunic and hose. No more she until we're back in the castle.
The dream moves forward, past the place where she last woke. Yet the strangeness does not abate completely. Arsinoe is still disoriented, and in awe, staring up at the white cliffs overlooking the bay, in a mainland country she has never been to, and in a time she does not know. But it is only a dream. And in any case, she cannot seem to will herself awake. Daphne, along with Henry, they seem to have left Richard at the port, enter the castle via a hidden passageway through the cliffs, their way guided by lanterns until they reach the end, and Daphne steps behind a hanging curtain to change into her girl's clothes. Off comes the tunic and scratchy hose, and on goes a high-waisted red dress.
Blah, I change my mind. This dress is even less comfortable than the tunic.
But even worse than that is the long black wig.
Daphne, your wig is askew.
Henry holds out the lantern and tugs the wig on properly. Then he tops it with a terrible veiled headdress. Trapped inside Daphne, Arsinoe grimaces. As Daphne fumbles with the wig again, Arsinoe tries to look around. She cannot, of course, which is frustrating. But she is asleep, and this is only a dream, so she is not bothered too much.
I'm sorry, Daph, says Henry. Women's wardrobes are truly a mystery to me.
The girls in the tavern tell a different story, she grumbles, and prods him in the ribs.
I believe I would like to hear that story.
This boy, Henry, is nearly as handsome as Joseph. Tall and lean, with straight, thick brown hair, the color of an oiled walnut shell. A pity he had not been the one changing clothes behind the sheet. In the dream, Daphne and Henry step out of the passageway.
In the corner of her vision, Arsinoe sees that they came from a door hidden behind a tapestry of hunting dogs. Daphne smooths the waist of her dark red gown, and Henry adjusts the fall of her white veil. He pulls his hands away quickly at the sound of a voice.
My lord, your lady mother wishes to see you. To see you both. All right, where is she? Waiting in her privy chamber, my lord.
Privy chamber? What exactly is a privy chamber? Arsinoe watches, carried easily along inside Daphne's body as they make their way to the chamber. She studies the woman they bow to, must be Henry's lady mother, as well as the relative plainness of the room. The woman is obviously high-born, dressed in a fine gown and cloth of silver, but the rug beneath their feet is thinner than Arsinoe is used to, and the stone walls very rough.
Mother, what is it? You look positively gleeful.
And I am, she says as Henry bends to kiss her hand.
It is good news, then, says Daphne. That is a relief.
We have had a letter from the king. Henry is to go to the Isle of Fenburn. He is to be this generation's suitor for the crown, the only one sent in all of Centra.
Fenburn?
Fenburn? Henry looks at Daphne excitedly. He's a suitor. But why am I dreaming of a suitor and his sister? She feels something in the way that Henry grasps onto Daphne's hand. Or perhaps not a sister.
But why me, mother? Are you certain? Has there been no mistake?
We have no reason to think so, his mother says. The letter was signed by the king's own hand and sealed with his seal. And we are always among his favorites at court. This is a boon to your father in payment for past loyalties.
Kings, Centran courts. I don't know anything about Centra. Mirabella ought to be dreaming this. She knows everything.
When do I leave? Henry asks.
Soon, says his mother. Very soon. Our young ward Richard will accompany you to the Isle and remain there during your suit as an ally and protection.
What about Daphne?
Daphne will remain here.
Henry and Daphne look at each other with wide eyes, and Arsinoe's heart aches for them. It is the same way she looked at Jules when she and Camden sailed away.
But mother...
No.
His mother takes a breath, and her face brightens. Now go and prepare for supper. Your lord father is sorry to miss tonight's celebration, but he will return from court in a week's time to see you off.
They stand, and his mother kisses Henry on both of his cheeks. Daphne starts to leave with him, but his mother grasps her by the arm.
I would keep you a moment, Daphne.
Daphne and Arsinoe sink back into the chair, though Arsinoe's eyes follow Henry as long as they can.
You knew this day would come, his mother says, that someday Henry would make a great marriage and increase our lands and our fortune.
Of course I did.
And even though a stranger, Arsinoe can hear the strain in Daphne's voice.
But I thought he would remain here, that his bride would come, with her lands and titles, and she and Henry would live here.
And so she will, if he is successful. He will return a king, with a queen, as soon as their reign on Fenburn is over.
Inside Daphne, Arsinoe sneers.
And what am I to do, Lady Redville? Without Henry? Without Richard?
You will do what all women do. You will wait for the men to make their ways in the world.
Ah.
Do not despair.
You are a foundling of no noble blood, so there can be no great marriage for you. But you will always have a place in my household as one of my ladies, and I am sure that Henry's queen would have you as a lady as well.
I suppose it's better than being put out on the street,
which is where my sister and I would be without Billy. Luckily, the uncomfortable conversation with Henry's mother, Lady Redville, does not last long, and Daphne is able to carry Arsinoe out and back into the hall, where Henry promptly ambushes them.
Well, did you change your mind?
Me? Why don't you? You're her son, and you didn't say a word.
His hair is windblown, and though boys seemed older by that age in those old times, to Arsinoe, he still looks very young. Too young to be a king consort, and so unschooled in the ways of the island. She can imagine Billy standing so, talking to his sister Jane, with a similar thoughtful expression.
I didn't know what to say, says Henry. She has never tried to separate us before.
It is a fool's time to start, when you're being sent so far away under newly minted favor of the king. And the Isle of Fenburn? Who knows a thing about it? They say it is full of witches and magic.
Watch your tongue, foundling.
You don't believe that, he says.
But how would we know? Sentra hasn't had a winning suitor for generations. Why is the king sending you anyway? He has plenty of sons.
Fenburn is a prize for nobles, Daff. You know that.
That clever look on your face. You want to be king, don't you? You want to be the king of Fenburn Island.
Daphne, he laughs. Who would not? It will be a great adventure. I wish you could come, but I will tell you everything when I return.
They are quiet for a moment, and that look of separation comes back into Henry's eyes. He loves her.
He loves her, but he's going to go anyway.
I don't want you to go, she says suddenly.
You don't? Dav,
he reaches out, and she turns quickly away.
Why do you not want me to go?
You know why.
Do I?
Do you?
Spit it out then, Daphne.
Arsinoe tries to prod, to quicken Daphne's mind, but she is only a dreamer, and this is far, far in the past. Whatever happened, there is no changing it.
You know that I can protect you just as well as Richard,
Daphne says, and Arsinoe groans.
I should be going with you. Who will look out for you? Who will make sure that you're safe?
Henry's hands draw back to his sides.
I wish you had said something else.
What else?
You think of me still as a child. How can you not see what I have become? That I am not some tottering little boy.
Henry...
Well, I am not a boy. I am a man. I will be a king. And I will be a lord, your lord,
he adds. And Arsinoe likes him a little less.
Dav, forgive me. I didn't mean it that way.
But that's the way it is, Daphne snaps. Thank you, Lord Henry, for reminding me.
He storms out, and she spins so fast that Arsinoe is near sick to her stomach. But when she stops, it is to face a mirror. And Arsinoe sees why she is dreaming in the body that she is. Daphne's hair and eyes are black as night, even her natural hair cropped short and barely peeking out from beneath the wig. Daphne may be a foundling, but she is a foundling queen. A Fenburn. Indrid Down Temple. Anxious butterflies tumble in Bree Westwood's stomach as the carriage draws to a stop before Indrid Down Temple. The carriage door swings open, and she looks up, taking it all in. The grandeur of the facade, so fiercely black, with carved gargoyles snarling down. It is not as beautiful as the temple in Rolanth. It lacks the soft, artful touches. But she must admit, it is imposing. Struck in the center of the capital like a great black sword into the earth.
Do you need someone to go in with you, miss? The driver asks. Announce you?
No. Bree steps out of the coach and rolls her shoulders back. I am expected. Her legs kick out in long strides, the show of confidence easy after years of practice. But she hates the wobbly feeling in her knees and the butterflies still boiling in her belly. She hates that High Priestess Luca summoned her at all.